On behalf of LSE Cities, good evening and welcome to this book launch on Too Big. What a wonderful title. Here it is. Rebuild by Design, a Transformative Approach to Climate Change by Henk Ovink and his colleague Jelte Boyenga. Is
that right?
Good. I know at least my name, how to pronounce it. My name is Philip Brode. I'm the Executive Director of LSE Cities, a center here at the school I run with Ricky Burdett. And on behalf of LSE Cities, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Henk and our panelist, Joe Da Silva, who I'll introduce in a moment. Before that, let me just kick this evening off with a few opening remarks. Every year, the World Economic Forum publishes its report on global risks, which includes a key diagram on the current risk landscape. Maybe some of you have seen it. It's quite a popular diagram to refer to. And it matches two central axes, one on potential level of risks, of a whole range of global risks, and on the other axis, the likelihood of these risks occurring. And quite consistently, more or less ever since this was published for the first time, top-level risks, which combine both extremes, high impact and high likelihood, belong to the broader environmental category, and specifically to first, extreme weather events, second, natural disasters, and third, failure of climate change mitigation and adaptation. Now, this is an observation which, of course, links us directly to tonight's theme and the idea of certainly big and possibly even too big. Now, but rather than a statement of resignation, a la too big to do anything about it, Henk's new book is, of course, the opposite. It's a call for climate action beyond business as usual, where too big serves as a guiding principle for a new politics, a new acceptance of ambiguities, and a recognition of the enormity of the collective global task ahead of us. It's also a reminder of what President Obama said, and I'm shamelessly quoting from the book itself, and he said wonderfully, "We are the first generation to feel the effect of climate change and the last generation to do anything about it." The three sub-themes of the book, or there are several sub-themes, but there are three which in particular link to, in some ways, the theme also of our center, LSE Cities, and the whole overall notion of urban development and often the optimism with which we continue to shape cities around the world. And I just want to highlight these three, and we'll come back to some of them later on. First, there is the notion of complexity. Well, we can certainly think of cities as complex systems of systems that, on the one hand, are extremely vulnerable to all sorts of shocks and external disruptions, but at the same time, it's the complexity and their social complexity which have embedded effects of, you could call it, resilience. And we'll talk much more about this. A second very obvious observation is around the innovation that features in many cities. A place, a territory, where new solutions are being identified, progressive experimentation can take place, and often successful scaling is then added onto. And finally, there's the power of design, where the city is, of course, a place of deliberate design intervention, and that not just in relation to the materiality, the physicality of the city, but in relation to institutional structures, urban governance. Now, that brings me to the structure of tonight, and we'll do this slightly differently. So we'll have a slightly shorter presentation by Henk, maybe up to 30 minutes, and then we'll do a conversation to test some of the three, four, five big two bigs, these key components of the book, where Henk argues we need to really remind ourselves of doing things differently. And we'll also want to give you the opportunity then ask questions. Hopefully that's going to be the last 30 minutes. If you want to tweet, please use the Twitter handle @LSEHenkOvink. Now, that brings me to the introduction of our two panelists, and I'll start with Henk. Henk is the first special envoy for International Water Affairs, a position he was appointed to by the Dutch cabinet in 2015. As the ambassador for water, he's responsible for advocating water awareness around the world, focusing on building institutional capacity and coalitions amongst governments, multilateral organizations, private sector and NGOs to address the world's need on water and help develop innovative solutions. Henk is also Sherpa on the UN and the World Bank high-level panel on water. And he is the principal, and this directly relates to the book for tonight, for Rebuild by Design, the resilience innovation competition he developed and led for the US Presidential Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force, where he was senior advisor to the chair. Previously, Henk was Director General for Planning and Water Affairs and Director for National Spatial Planning for the Ministry of Infrastructure and the Environment in the Netherlands. Now, after Henk's talk, Jo will in some ways do two things. She'll be a respondent and discussant. And Jo da Silva is directing international development at the engineering firm Arup, where she's also global leader city resilience. As a professional civil engineer, Jo has been responsible for the design and delivery of significant infrastructure projects in Asia, Africa, Europe, and for both public and private sectors. She has also worked extensively with the United Nations, World Bank, and NGOs in the aftermath of disasters and on development programs focusing on risk reduction and resilience. Her research into the characteristics of resilient community has been incorporated in the International Federation of the Red Cross Framework for Community Resilience. She has also worked with the Rockefeller Foundation on the Asia Cities Climate Change Resilience Network and led the development of the City Resilience Index, which still is being used by the 100 Resilient Cities Program by Rockefeller. She has a doctorate of technology from Coventry University and was made officer of the British Empire for her services to engineering and humanitarian response, and was awarded very recently the Gold Medal by the Institution for Structural Engineers in 2017. So let's kick this off with Henk. You're already timing 30 minutes. Very good. And then we'll have it more interactive.
Welcome. Thank you very much for joining me. This is also a little bit of an experiment for me, because I've never done this before. This is I've edited and wrote on 6 books on design and politics, but I never wrote a full book. I did a book launch in New York, but you could say it was among friends, and we had like 20 people on stage in several aspects. And now I have to talk about the whole book in 30 minutes. So it's an experiment. If it fails, you know, I learned a lot, and I hope you learned a lot too. This is the book. I do start with this, though. I make it a little bigger, because this is our plan. And probably you all know this image, but if you don't, there is a story behind it. This is actually the first singular image made, photo made from planet Earth. 1972, Apollo 17 made the first singular image of the planet. And it was, you know, back on Earth, it created the sense of, wow, on one, but then second, whoa, that's vulnerable. So it at first, you know, from the first time in man's history, we were able to see our planet, and we also saw it was not flat, of course, but and it was very blue with a lot of water, 71%. But the vulnerability of us struck. There was no planet. There was no one next to it. There was no planet B. There was nothing. This is what we had to take care of. Now I'll bring you back to last year, where the World Meteorological Organization, and I consider them as a very trustworthy, fact-based organization. You know, in my imagination, men and women in white coats behind computers doing their job, they came up with their report and said, David Carlson, who's leading the climate research program, said something that really scared me, something that knocked me off my feet. Although I know it, traveling the world and going to all these vulnerable places, is that WMO said we don't know anymore. Climate change is so massive, it's impacting our society so rapidly and so extreme, and in 27, even without a strong El Nino, we will see other remarkable changes across the planet that are challenging the limits of our understanding of the climate system. We are in truly uncharted territory. Now, if my father at that time, 96, would have said that, I would have understood. But if the WMO actually tells me, as a water envoy, that they don't know anymore, that it's off the charts, it's getting scary. That was the same week. The G20 almost dropped climate change. The finance ministers got together in Germany. They almost dropped climate change out of their message. That's only 2 years after Paris. Only 2 years after the Sustainable Development Goals Agreement. Only 2 years after Addis Ababa, where we actually as a world got together to get to a finance agreement around sustainability and climate, it almost dropped out. With this, in 1 week, I started to worry, knowing that if the challenges around climate change are so big, we need everyone to actually make a difference and start a change. If these two drop out, where are we? Water is at the critical part of these challenges. 90% of all disasters is water-related. 80% of climate adaptation is related to water. Without water, no food, no energy, a lot of migrants, social instability. Without water, actually inequality. It's kids and women that walk the well, not men. If we bring water to this community, it's actually the women that help these communities progress. And the kids can go to school, and with sanitation, even girls can stay in school. So water is an environmental, social, economic, and cultural issue. But if we do it right, we can actually build resiliency and sustainability in our systems, in our cities, and our environment. So there's a critical, important notion of water when we talk about this. And New York faced this in 2012, October 29, when Hurricane Sandy, moving along the east coast of the U.S., took a left turn, as was projected by the Dutch WMO. We had this line, said, it will take a left turn, and everybody said, it's impossible, but it did, and it hit New York front and center. And the red on the map is actually the water. The water went everywhere. It actually went 50% beyond the flood maps of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. So, two times as much flooding physically, and that flood hit everyone, but not everyone as hard. Water is discriminating. Sorry for the mic, but I have to point this out. This is Jersey City, just as an example. So the water moves in miles, and this is an industrial site, but it's also a low-income community. This is where the surge was 6 meters high. But that water was not ocean water. It was contaminated water because of all the industry. They stored Agent Orange. They had chemical factories. Everything was there. After the storm, after the water left, the Environmental Protection Agency had to close the playground because, in the words of one of the neighbors, the soil lit up at night. So all of a sudden, a disaster, a natural disaster, you could say, of a surge became a man-made disaster, even increasing the burden on the vulnerable. Poor people live in poor places all over the world, also in the U.S. In Queens, where the illegal immigrants in the basements of all those garages that were flooded, that had no insurance and had no way to get back on their feet. I categorized the book, together with Jelte Boeinga, into different aspects of this challenge. One, it is too big to ignore. This massive challenge of climate change. It might be the biggest challenge ever, but it's not too big to take on, but it's too big to ignore. It's too big to simplify, like we like to do, eh? We like to tweet about it, or deal with it in our silos, or within our professions, or with among friends. But we have to embrace the complexity of this challenge, because in that embracing, and that understanding of the interdependencies, the vulnerabilities, lies also the understanding of the opportunities to intervene. It's too big for our systems in a way, because the way we deal with it might actually be changed, as also needs to be changed. If we replicate the past, we create more disasters in the future. Solutions of yesterday are the problems of tomorrow. So, and that means in our way we produce solutions, but also in the way we organize ourselves. And to do this right, we have to do it with everyone. And it's tough, because that not only means with your friends and colleagues, but also with the ones you don't know, or the ones you know but you don't like, and the ones you actually are afraid of, and that is from a personal or professional point of view, as much as from an institutional point of view. And fragmentation is impossible. Every time we silo this up, every time we find a way forward within our own silo, within agriculture or energy or housing or food, we mess up. Power of design is the power of connecting those challenges. And the urgency is big, so we have to act now. Now, an example of what happened in the Hurricane Sandy and what you saw after the water left. These are extracts from the book I will go through with you. Sandy hit New York October 29th, and President Obama immediately installed, after his re-election, the Hurricane Sandy, the Presidential Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force. A task force that was aimed not at three, had three objectives. One, to bring aid on the ground immediately. Second, to repair the region's critical infrastructure. But third, and that was the most ambitious, to start to prepare that region for the future. This region, damaged by Hurricane Sandy, a region where here in Hoboken and Red Hook, it's not there, you see the water level on the wall, on the left. So this region hit hard, how to prepare that for the future. Here you see President Obama with Chris Christie on the beach. And this was the day after the storm. This was also a week before his re-election. This was the week where Governor Christie, you can't imagine it looking at the past election, but Governor Christie said, this is a good president. Because he joined forces with anyone on the beach. It was not like with Bush in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. It took him a while before he took a helicopter to fly over a war zone, because New Orleans turned into a war zone. It was a president who was immediately on the ground. It's also the president that said, when he started office in 2009, no Katrina on my watch. I don't want an inefficient, ineffective, malfunctioning, not knowing what to do federal government. So already in 2009, he started to prepare a new approach to disaster. And that meant in 2012, when Sandy hit, they were not ready, but they were more prepped than any president before. The Sandy Task Force did not come from the sky. It was not an idea as an expert. It came from a strategy this president had. And he asked Sean Donovan, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, so the one that really understood what cities and communities were, where the social interest came first in policy and investment, to chair this task force. Now, Sean went for a vacation that Christmas to Berlin, and he called me, where I was Director General for Planning and Water in the Netherlands, and said, Hank, I need to know about the Netherlands, because we have a flooding issue. And I said, well, you're welcome. So he came to the Netherlands January 2 and 3 with his family, his two boys and his wife. And I toured him around to anything that had to do with water. So that meant urban infrastructure, governance programs, finance instruments, regional water authorities, flood prevention measured by a community that was done by hand, and in bigger infrastructure. Building with nature, building in our cities, in our subways, and so forth. Every scale I could fit into these 2 days, every person, every authority that he could fit in these 2 days. But I also got to know him because I didn't know him. Right? We came to the Netherlands, and he said, I want to learn about the way you deal with this. And there was a click. And after 2 days, I came home, and I said to my wife, I want to help. So I said, will you join me? Which was, of course, a question. And she said, sure, let's move to the U.S. So I sent him an email and said, if you're serious, because I thought, and I wrote to him, I think Hurricane Sandy could be a game changer for the U.S. in the way they approach climate change, in the way they approach resilience. If you agree, I'm willing to work with you. But I hope I'm not forward enough. I hope I'm not too forward. And he responded like when he landed on the plane, and he, you know, he talked to his wife Liza and said, is this guy serious? This is how he tells it. Does he want to work with us? And he said, well, you're exactly forward enough. When can you start? So we packed our bags, we moved to the US, we started to work on the task. Now, why did he come to the Netherlands? Just a couple of slides. The Netherlands is a watery place with a lot of water. But we were able to manage our way around it by making land, turning water into land, organizing ourselves. So this was not only engineering and design, this was governance and collaboration and inclusion. This is about getting everyone behind this massive task and finding a way forward that was sustainable and resilient, based on the principles of safety and quality. So not only a way to move towards a dry place, but a place of prosperity and equity and quality. We build our land in polders, our cities around water, but also institutional frameworks. Water is part of our constitution. It's part of our agencies, part of a program that looks ahead 100 years for our kids, and they appointed even a water handbook to look at water. Now, Sandy was a big disaster. Almost 160 people died, 650,000 homes damaged or destroyed, and $65 billion in debt. So that's a lot of money for a big storm, the second costliest storm in the U.S. It was too big to ignore, as is the whole climate issue. As I explained, WMO is right. It's off the charts, but it means it is too big to ignore. We are at a turning point. So if we add all challenges up and we look at the future, and we see the doom and gloom of the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum, as Philip said, is right. It tells us that if you bring your kids to bed and you ask them, did you have a great day? And they say yes, you actually have to tell them, you better, because tomorrow will be worse. More impacts of crisis and more frequent impacts. And it means that facing this challenge, If I talk to a crowd that's a little older than you are, people are, I want to go back. Populism is on the rise because in the 50s, things were simple. And simpler solutions provided actually opportunities for change. But if you look ahead, and if I talk to the young, they say actually it's an opportunity. If only we can connect the dots. If only we can understand that complexity, connect the dots and find sustainable and resilient ways forward. But there's a disconnect between the solutions of the past and the challenges of tomorrow. And I use a metaphor. I think you know it. Kids play with it. Do you know it? Yeah? We use it in our engineering school as an assessment tool. You fix it in a minute, you admit it. Joe did it in 10 seconds, I think. You play with it, you have to study sociology or economy or something else. But it's a metaphor for the world. We build a system. And the cube is our system. The way of governance, the way of allocating money, the way to interact. But that system produces solutions. Now with climate change and urbanization and food demand and energy change, the solutions of the past don't fit the challenges of tomorrow. So we have to perhaps not change the system, but find a way around it. Around it, if we want to meet the sustainable development goals, if we want to meet the goals we agreed upon in Paris. This biggest challenge ever, we have to embrace in all its complexity. And as you see, I go through the book as well, so you've almost read it. Now, Sean was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and he believed in competitions. He said, winners and losers create competition and often bring out the best in people. They strive, they bring new ideas that they wouldn't otherwise bring. And you're able to spend the money to do something to a depth or scale that you're not able to do if everybody just gets a little piece. So no peanut butter, he said. Let's not spread it around. So it can become comprehensive. Can become a beacon or a shining example, and it shows a way, a path to something that is strong. But that is not easy, a competition. In the United States, the competition was institutionalized in a law. America competes with an office, the Office of Science and Technology Policy. But that demanded that the government put out a question to the world, to society, and say, this is the problem, give me a solution. And I challenged the president. I challenged Sean Donovan, but I also challenged America Competes, and I said, we don't know the question. We have to do a deep dive into this region with everything and everyone we can find to find the questions. We have to find what is wrong and right, where vulnerabilities in the dependencies are, to find ways forward in defining that question. So the designer is not tasked with a question a government poses on him, or a community does not get the opportunity because the government, the federal government, tells him or her it's about renewable energy or integrated infrastructure investment. No, it has to be a collaborative approach. It has to be a process moving forward. Now, the CEO of the task force, Marion McFadden, actually said about her own agency, Housing and Urban Development, we had a joke at HUD, we find the no in innovation. So it was not only a challenge between me and the chair, but also between Sean and his own agency. Innovation is an interesting word, but you challenge the existing part, and that's a tough sell. But we did. Developing the competition started in March when I moved to the US and lasted until June. And that competition got the approach that I wanted. I didn't know what to ask, so I asked for talent. We did a call to the world, a request for qualification, not a request for proposals. And that call asked for talent, and it brought 148 teams to our table. We selected 10, all comprised of different professionals, engineers, designers, social scientists, economists, ecologists, environmentalists, activists, former politicians, bureaucrats, and everyone in those teams. So we had 250 professionals on the team side. And then we went to the region. This intense research approach where they touched upon everything and everyone. We brought them to mayors, to communities, to Occupy Sandy, to whoever. In the end, they met with 535 stakeholders on the community level in the region. More than 30 universities involved. We had NGOs and government agencies, 180 government agencies on top of it, and 6 philanthropic funders. So the massiveness of that approach brought the wealth of insight, of understanding. Because the talent of the man on the ground, or the woman, that actually lost his house, his daughter, his family, his business, or a combination, is as important as the professional on the side that can actually help provide solutions for it. And it touches upon the complexity. Now, you might not know Alexander von Humboldt, but some of you do. If you don't, read the book by Andrea Wolf. If you do, read the book too. It's his biography. You read it on a plane ride or a train ride, I must say, from a sustainability point of view, of course. And von Humboldt understood the three complexities. He lived 200 years ago. And he mapped the complexity of our environment, you could say, of our planet. He understood the complexity of our planet, for one. He was able to make the connections, not only on a place, but between regions on a global level. Second, he understood the complexity of man, of interaction, on how we deal with each other. So the social side. So he was able to not only connect the dots in an ecological, environmental, and way, but also in a social level. But thirdly, he understood the complexity of power, of decision makers. He talked to the then president of the United States, as much as to the emperor in Germany, as with his professors and presidents of universities across the world, to influence their policy. Mostly to fund his travel, but his travel was dedicated to his research to get a better understanding of this complexity. I advocate for a long-term comprehensive approach that's connected to short-term innovation. At the same time, this is a plan that's a book on the shelf that's worthless. These are projects that are lost because of fragmentation, if not connected. If we do this inclusively, by collaboration, and transparent, so we learn and evaluate and learn from our mistakes, you build capacity. You build capacity among individuals as well as among institutions. And that's critically important. And to connect this, I use the design approach. The design approach of rebuild by design. Now, I'll skip this. We needed funding for the process, so we asked foundations to help us. We needed support partners, so we worked with universities, the Regional Plan Association, and the Municipal Art Society. And our scientists actually told us, go bold. Klaus Jacob was part of the research group, and he actually said, any answer you come up with in the frame of 2050 is not enough. You have to go beyond, at least in the way you evaluate, and at least in the way you start to design. Perhaps not in the first step of implementation, but make sure you can incrementally build resiliency in this region. And our designers were so much connected to the political world, to the communities, that they started to understand what decision-making is. So after the research phase, I'll do the teams. We had the big team with Bjarke Ingels Group, One Architecture, and Arcadis. We had HRNA advisors. We had an Interboro team. With the MIT team, with ZUS and the Urbanism, an OMA team with Royal Heskoning, Penn Design, the university, with Olin Landscape Architect, Sasaki, Rutgers, and Arab in one team, Scape Landscape Architecture, Wagoner Ball on a bridge with Yale and Arcadis, and WHY and West A, going across the region. And they started to talk with everyone in community meetings all over. Now, we created, with Rebuild by Design, a safe place. A place where it was not about negotiation, but about collaboration. And the simple difference is that with a negotiation, you know what you want. So you enter a conversation, and when you leave, you have 80% or 90% if you're good, and 40% if you're bad. But you always lose, right? With collaboration, you don't know what you want, but you know what you can bring. So, and with that, you create added value through that collaboration. So you're surprised. You get something new. You create something common. But for that, an environment where trust and not distrust is critically important. So we created a free place with design. We didn't go alone. We needed everyone to bring aboard. And that's what we tried with this inclusive approach built on trust. Now, the research that came out was then used by the federal government, and it scared us a little. In this world of experimentation and all the research we did, we thought we're going to use it for our own means to get to a conclusion where to focus on. After the research, the White House called and said, we're going to use the research to allocate the funding to other parts of the region. And that institutional capacity was, of course, the objective. But when it happens, it's still a little scary. And you think you experiment with rebuild by design, and then the White House actually validates your experiment and said, we're going to use this to allocate the rest of the funding to the other parts. Halfway the competition, it almost blew up in our face. Under the title, This is Our Money, and you have to imagine that the $60 billion went out in tranches, and that tranches, when it came to the development block grant funding, went to a state or a city, and they would make a plan, and that plan had projects, and those projects were implemented. And with Rebuild, we turned it around. Yeah? We made the plan together, federal government, state, and community, and cities, and businesses, and then we would implement those projects based on the common plan. But Governor Christie and Governor Cuomo said, don't touch our money, we want it back. But thanks to the right interventions, it was solved. Now, what do I tell more? This is where they were. Perhaps a good idea. This is Manhattan. The big team focused on Manhattan to protect it. MIT focusing on the Meadowlands, the place that was totally flooded. The swamp, it used to be great, but is now polluted. OMA focuses on Hoboken with a comprehensive strategy to take Hoboken out. Skate building an eco reef in front of Staten Island. The Interporo team creating resiliency in the Long Island town in front of Long Island, focusing on perpendicular rivers along the coast. Team of HRNA in Hoboken, Rockaway Beach, and in Asbury Park, as was Sasaki Rutgers in Asbury Park, Toms River, and Union Beach. And then offshore, WHY West 8, focusing on creating resiliency really offshore with a big approach. Hunts Point, the food market by Penn Design, and in Bridgeport, Wagoner Bowl and Unabridged. They created solutions across the board. I won't do the deep dive because of time. Looking at critical infrastructure, social resiliency, and planning, communication strategies, and building capacity. They looked at flood walls as well as natural measures, working with the community to work on those solutions. And those solutions were in the end presented in front of a by design, presented in front of a jury. Let me go there. In the finals, we presented them not only to the jury, but also to the public. Always both in New Jersey as well as in New York. In a space where they could capture 600 people, 1,000 people came to look at the designs. And the days after, the jury evaluated 10 proposals and selected six. Six of them that were strikingly different. Eco Barrier Reef by Skate, the Meadowlands projects by MIT, WXY and West 8 were not awarded with fund, but I really like their project because it's a very bold move to move towards resiliency. OMA in Hoboken and Interboro on Long Island, and last, the big team on Manhattan. Last is the implementation. The projects now are in the implementation phase. And this is where I'm faced with this cube, the cube and the forum. So we were asked and tasked to develop innovation stuff. Projects that really capture the future and were able to bring the community, the government, and the business into that future. But now the agencies that have to implement them struggle because they have a cube to evaluate and assess them. And how can they progress it? So working with, and I still work with them, luckily New Jersey has a new Democratic governor, and his commissioner just, I'm on the phone with him tomorrow and last weekend to see how we can actually accomplish this ambition. New York City, of course, looks more easy. Still, even a city like New York is challenged by its own regulation and its own default response to try to fit the project within their system instead of to adapt the system to their project. The urgency, and I hope I got that right, is massive. But the opportunity is also immense. If we grasp that complexity by all, with all, matching all stakeholders, all interests, we can actually deal with the future. And as I write in the book, it's not so hard. Make mistakes and learn. Innovate, include, and integrate. Inspire and do it over and over again. Out of conviction, belief, ambition, and the need to change now, fast and all the way. Too big? Not at all. Look past the obstructions for the opportunities. Rebuild by Design was built on this promise. There is always an opportunity for change and impact. And there's only one way to take it. Making the effort. Leapfrogging by learning, by design and deliberation, in true collaboration. We all can do it. If we have the shared will and ambition to make the world a better place. And it's great to do. Thank you.
Henk, thank you very much. Sticking to the time, 30 minutes, 270 pages. We have now seen all of them.
Yeah.
So, wonderful. That's a very good start.
Now, what
we want to do for the remainder of tonight is not go into the specifics of how this particular project was delivered. But to go back to the opening page, the big red, and I saw some of you taking photos of it. Here are these, it's almost five hypotheses which one can test. And we want to talk about those. We want to use, of course, this book as a case study from which we extract. And the first, too big, is the most obvious one. Too big to ignore. The biggest challenge ever. How could we disagree? Joe, if I may just pass over to you to offer your thoughts and then maybe provoke with Henk a few points which we can drill into.
So Henk, firstly, thank you for an inspiring talk. I'm hugely looking forward to reading the book. I wasn't involved personally in the Rebuild by Design program, but at the same time I was working very closely with the Rockefeller Foundation, and almost all the characters which you've got cartoons of I've met at one time or another. And I was always very well aware that it was an incredibly unique and special process. I mean, it was really innovation at scale. And I just want to thank you for taking the time and the trouble to capture it so that we can all learn from it. The issue of too big to ignore is so sort of fundamental to the urgency that's now behind climate change. I started working on climate change in cities in 2007 in Asia. We were working in 10 cities in 4 different countries. And when we first started working there, I was blown away. I went to Asia believing that climate change was going to happen sometime in the future. And I very quickly realized it was already happening. It was day-to-day, a day-to-day reality for everyone involved. And when Hurricane Katrina happened in 2005, I confessed this to him earlier, my immediate reaction was, oh good. Now you might think that's a very strange reaction, but it was actually, at last, a major event in a major city that will actually get global attention and make the world wake up. But it didn't. It was blamed on the engineering, it was blamed on the social issues in New Orleans. And we kind of went to sleep. And then New York, which was some people who don't live in London, they would argue New York is the greatest city in the world. I would beg to differ. Then this happens in New York. And the world did wake up. But the question that I have for you, Henk, is why did they wake up in New York? Was it just because it was the capital of, you know, one of the biggest economies in the world? And why did everyone start going to sleep again? And have then started reawakening now with Hurricane Harvey. And how frequently do you think these disasters have to happen for us to start taking it seriously?
Thank you, Joe. And thank you for joining this conversation. This is the tough question. Yeah? With Katrina, you could still say there was on the federal level in the US, a government in denial. We tried, even as a Dutch government, we called the federal government and they said no, and we called the state and then they said no, and then we called the city and they said yes, so we were able to provide aid on the ground, which was at the right level, of course, but this is what you do from a national perspective. The government was in denial. It took President Bush a while before he jumped into a helicopter to actually fly over the war zone that was created because of the response. And when Obama started, there was a different approach. But then again, I mean, Obama's now saying too. His energy policy, there are big questions you can actually think about. But climate change was at least front and center. So the political conversation in the US, and thanks to the US with the rest of the world, was different. I remember John Podesta being the advisor to the president, chief of staff to Bill Clinton, who advised President Obama on climate as well as on healthcare. What more do you want, as an advisor? He brokered the deal between Obama and Xi Jinping. And it was a year before we came out with our... that was in the same year we came out with our Sandy Task Force report. So it was this culture where anything seemed a little bit more possible. Second, and I, you know, in my capacity as an MFA, I travel the world. I agree, London is probably the best city in the world. But wherever I go, people know New York. I talk to a little boy in Khulna, in Bangladesh, or a girl in Chennai, or in Piura, in Peru. There is this imaginative capacity with that city. And all of a sudden, you know, look at the disaster movies. It's New York that is flooded, right? You see them again, you know, you have these turns. So it's the iconic city is not, you know, is hit hard. So that's helpful to the narrative, eh? To the narrative that we are all vulnerable. That it's not only the developing world. And I agree with you. When last year Harvey hit Houston, at the same time 1,200 people died in Bangladesh, India, Nepal because of floods. It was like nothing in the news. It was like, you know, front page Harvey, then page 10, 1,200. And I talked to my friends in Bangladesh and I said, how do you feel? How does, you know? And they said, yeah, it's great. Because we don't like the disasters, and also we don't want to applaud Harvey for, you know, bringing casualties to Houston. But thanks to Harvey, we're at least talking about this, not as a developing world issue, but as a global issue. The Paris Agreement was also in that context. The world came together and signed the deal, and never did so many countries actually sign up for such a deal. To move the world to a 2-degree, preferably 1.5-degree world. So there is a change. My question is, how are we going to deliver on that promise? Because the challenge is so massive, and the despair and destruction with these disasters all over the world, and the response to that is still repair and not resiliency. And that is not only with too much water. As big, you know, 250 million climate refugees we will have in 2050. And already wars and social unrest and instability is caused exactly because of not enough water. So climate change is posing this huge threat. So it's massive. So it's, I think the conversation changed, but not enough.
Yeah. Joe, Henk almost forces us to move on, but I want to make sure whether... you have another point on too big to ignore and the related biggest challenge.
No, I mean, I think where you were going with that last part of the conversation was the major challenge we simply have in terms of making climate change real. I mean, you know, climate change, it's too hot, too dry, too wet. You know, we can break it down to that. But actually, when you're working in communities, in cities, is what does it really look like to a family? And it's whether the water is this high or this high. It's whether the water lasts, goes away after a week or 2 weeks. Because, you know, that's the difference between a family being able to cope or not cope. And I think there's a real challenge with the discourse in terms of actually shifting the language from the way we talk about these events in terms of losses, loss of life, economic losses, more abstract numbers, you know, with billions. We can't picture billions of dollars. You know, we can picture 1,000 people or 2,000 people. But actually, when you look at Superstorm Sandy, the loss figure that really struck me was 8.5 million people were without power. That was the one that just stopped me in my tracks. Actually, only about 186 people died. Very few. The economic losses were much less than Katrina, about 2/3. But 8.5 million people without power was completely astonishing. And then when you start thinking about our dependency on infrastructure in the urban environments in which we live, and the cascading implications of loss of power on health systems, on water pumps, you know, and we just are totally ignorant and blind to it. We assume that it's just going to work until it doesn't work. And that's, for me, what the big change for me out of all the Superstorm Sandy was this. We realised that critical infrastructure could fail. You know, the pictures of the subways with the water, people couldn't get to school, people couldn't get to work. That's what climate change really means. It means our cities, coming to a standstill.
And then there is still the question. So on one, perhaps the way we talk about it, and with whom we talk. And I remember that it was the image of a man sprayed on a wall, "We all hate you, Sandy." And he did. He lost his daughter and his house and his business. So his hatred was real. Bringing him on board in the Sandy approach, making him understand that disaster, you know, is like massive for him on a personal level, but also, you know, he had to deal with it and had to rebuild and recoup and become a little more resilient. And he's a very sad man, but still he became part of the solution, not part of the problem. The other part is really understanding it. The storm hit Bangkok, the disruption in the production cycle hit the economies in the West. The drought in Russia actually created uproar in the Middle East because there was no transaction of grain anymore. So these interdependencies are massive thanks to globalization. But if we don't understand them, if we don't know what to do about them on the personal, on the business, on the government level, they stay absurd. It's either 8.5 million or 168 lives lost. But there are, news items and not become personalized. So we have to make them action, next to the narrative becoming more compelling or personal, the actionability of the personal part also has to increase. And that, it's stuck. I don't have an answer. It's, every time we reinvent something different. That's also, I think.
So this is a good segue into the proactive side of the story, which is obviously the biggest part of your message. Act now. The one chart which really I will remember very well, you introduced how over 100 years temperature populations are increasing, and you link this chart, which we're all very familiar with, to populism. And you look at it and, you really can't blame people for wanting to be back in the 1950s, where all of these complexities didn't exist. And we also constantly talk about how much the current populist wave is one which tries to simplify in the face of complexity. So this is our next big theme here, too big to simplify, embrace complexity. So you turned it around, you said all these big hockey stick endings is an opportunity. And Joe, I think you work a lot with complexity, with people who want to reduce complexity or ignore complexity.
Yeah, no, I love the title of that chapter, too big to simplify. And actually recognising that we live in this incredibly complex world, that cities are these incredibly dynamic environments. And we've actually, we've been educated, people like me who went to university in the 1980s, we were educated to be reductionist, I think particularly engineers. Luckily, I studied at Cambridge, and they taught me systems engineering, which is maybe why I've ended up where I've ended up. But we don't think in systems. We think about things. We think about outputs. We don't think about outcomes. And, the thing we're grappling with at the moment is we think about risk. And risk is saying, what's the hazard, and what's the consequence of the hazard? It's a very linear process, which starts with actually saying, we understand the hazard, and we can actually then work out what's going to happen as a result of that hazard. I mean, that is so simplistic, because we have no idea what's going to happen when a hurricane like Superstorm Sandy hits New York, all the different linkages and interdependencies. And so for me, complexity is absolutely fundamental to moving our thinking from risk to resilience. And actually thinking in a different way, where we're starting with accepting the complexity of the systems and saying bad things are going to happen. How are we going to make them stronger? And how are we going to find solutions that embrace that complexity? And that's what I love about the Rebuild Design experiment, is it just said, this is really difficult. It's a really messy problem. And actually, we're going to take time to get lots of different people with different perspectives from different backgrounds to simply understand the problem. I mean, that to me was completely astonishing. You know, the amount of people just involved, not in actually saying, this is our site, we're going to start making a solution, but just actually saying, this is New York. What's the problem? And engaging with real people to understand intuitively those interactions, because we can't break them down and analyse them in a reductionist way.
Thank you. I like the risk part. And if by resiliency we can move risk to reward, and then I not only talk about the financial reward, but if you take a more comprehensive approach and by understanding risk, also start to pull in interests and aspects that you know are not normally within your frame. If you're an energy specialist, you don't think about urban, you know, at first, or climate. This is your dedicated or within food sector and so forth. But the moment you increase your scope, the complexity increases, but it's actually the other way around, because reality is already complex. If you don't increase the scope, you fail. But from a professional point of view, if you increase the scope, you get the opportunity to pull in more interests and make connections that create a reward across that scheme. That means that I don't have to solve my problem within my field. I'll actually deal with the challenge, so it's not a singular problem. I deal with the complex challenge in the context of this complexity. And that means that I'll take some here and I'll give some there, but the balance sheet of that actually is resilient, reward by resiliency, you could almost say. So you move a world from risk to reward by a resilient approach. I'm Sherpa to the UN High Level Panel on Water, where we one thing I championed in the panel was valuing water from an economic and financial, but also social, cultural, and environmental way. And we came up with approaches that really started to pull in from all these different sectors their interests and mechanisms to capture added value from a comprehensive approach. We do it in the Netherlands with Room for the River, where by increasing the way this river can actually flow again naturally, you start to add values from an environmental, ecological, but also urban and economic point of view. And all of a sudden, one intervention that looks like a green infrastructure engineering approach is building capacity among businesses, farmers, society, environmentalists. And the added value that comes out of it actually also has an added value in an economic sense. But that means that you have to understand it. So embracing, don't break it down, don't silo it off, don't simplify it. Understand it in all its aspects. And we need business cases for that. And I think we're increasingly become better, also from an economic point of view, to not only do a cost-benefit analysis, but do a societal cost-benefit analysis, which is a comprehensive way in looking at it. And there's with Rebuild by Design, we did that too. In the end, the teams had to deliver four things. One, the research, which was half of it, so they already did that. Out of the research, three to five opportunities, and we selected one. Second, build a coalition in the place where you will work. So don't start to design first, but start to build a coalition with your stakeholders, public and private, individual, institutional. Third, a design, the first design of a project. And fourth, a benefit-cost analysis. And then we came across the impossibility of the federal government that the White House has its own benefit-cost analysis model. FEMA, DOT, Department of Transportation, FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, and then Housing and Urban Development had none. So they gave away the biggest chunk of money, $15 billion of the $60 billion, And they had no benefit cost analysis methodology. So we had to come up with our own approach that was comprehensive, that incorporated all these challenges, for the teams to have a reference that they did not only look at infrastructure, but look at urban investments for resiliency in the New York region.
What I think, I trained as an engineer. Engineers, you study engineering at university, and I think probably still there are no people in your course for 4 years. There are just things. You're designing things. So I love your wooden box slide with the things going in, and it's such a beautiful description of, my life went on, and I had a boss who realised that I was frustrated by something, and he said, Joe, the technology's easy. It's people that are the difficult bit. And he said, they're also the most interesting bit. And then I got involved in post-disaster work, and I actually realised that people were it. They were sort of completely central to the issue. As sort of my life's gone on, realising the institutional complexity and the power dynamics that go on is really what defines the problems in the developing world where I work, primarily. I'm always an outsider. So I never assume that I know anything. I go in and I have to go and engage, or talk to as many people as possible to get an idea of the complexity of the situation, because my starting point is I know nothing.
Right.
And I think that was, it's actually, to me, that's a real shift in mindset. Particularly if we're educated people who have gone to good universities like LSE, we tend to think that we know the answers. Where, if you're trained as an engineer, you're designed to find solutions. And actually to pause and say, no, this is so complex, we've actually got to kind of walk around this a little bit and think about it. And actually, what's the problem here that we're actually trying to solve? And I think, we do just completely oversimplify. But the other thing that doesn't come out in your two big titles, but I think is really important, is I was interested how the program dealt with also the uncertainty about the future. This phrase, build back better in the aftermath of disasters, or let's increase resilience, the Obama's third pillar of the strategy, which was let's actually think about the future and make these communities stronger. But actually, we're beginning to wake up that we really don't know what the future holds. We don't know whether we're going to make it to 2 degrees or whether it's going to be 3 degrees. We don't know, if you're working in Africa, what cities are going to look like in when you've got increases in population, 5-7% a year. You have no idea what the city's going to look like in the future. And these big infrastructure projects and urban planning projects historically have typically been designed for lifespans of 50, 100, 200 years. So if we're moving into a new realm of having to do things differently because they're complex, we're also having to do it because it's very uncertain. Did that come up at all in the discourse?
Yeah, for multiple reasons. To be honest, one of those reasons was very opportunistic. We didn't have enough money to give the engineer the idea that he or she could actually solve everything with it. So that was nice. So knowing that there was not $10 billion to spend on a project, but hundreds of millions, meant that you had to think about incremental resiliency. That came with the notion, of course, of adaptivity. Uncertainty, part of a planning process, means that the planning itself has to be adapted. Not redundant in the sense that it can cope with everything, but really adaptive. And that helped that in the Netherlands we just at that time prepared our Delta program, our program for 2100, that at the core of the policy said adaptive Delta management. So while focused at 2100, there's no solutions in that program for 2050 or 2035. It's adaptation in the approach all over to ensure that we can incorporate changing risks, but also changing opportunities. I think we're getting, some people say there are no regrets, and in some situations there are. It's great to invest in, but then you have to be able to have a platform to reinvent yourself. Whatever you do now should not become the burden for a next generation, to that level. And that level of the uncertainty is critically important in all the investments we take on. And I think if I may use this for our earlier discussion on how can we change, you know, how can we really bring that type of change, a lot of our attention is focusing specifically on the climate change policy and the funds that are connected to it. But if you look at the world of investments, like this is the investment pot of infrastructure, like the normal. It's like this giant, bucket of money. And the next one is that perhaps even smaller. It's like it's this cup of climate change funding. And then we say, this is our holy grail. This should change that. Which will not. Although it takes a million to spend a billion wisely, we have to make the principles of this funding part of the principles of that. You see it happening. And when you start to influence from these examples, like with Rebuild by Design and with the task force, we also created resiliency infrastructure guidelines. Very obscure. How to spend your money as a federal government. Very bureaucratic. I don't even think Governor Christie saw them. But every agency on the federal level had to implement them. I don't even think Trump knows that his Department of Transportation has resiliency infrastructure guidelines as a mechanism to direct funding. And that type of change helps because they touch upon not the small parts of where all focus is on, but makes the connection between those innovations and the bigger jobs, and how can we move them forward?
Thank you. Now, in the interest of time, we'll skip the next two bigs, which are essentially institutional in nature. Too big for our systems, create a free place, and too big to go alone, be radically inclusive. It's very obvious that internationally also this resonates now much more than even a few years ago. The IPCC report, the latest one on questions of climate change adaptation, now no longer only talks about material preparedness, but social preparedness and the way communities can come together to produce resilience. But the last one we need to really quickly talk about, too big for fragmentation, the power of design. And I say why we need to talk about it, because in some ways there is a bit of a contradiction to complexity. There's still the language of integration, of comprehensiveness, of connecting the dots across. And I think that in some ways still doesn't sit that neatly against the complexity story. Joe, if you want to pick up on that and then we'll finish with
the question for me is that what are you designing for? I always argue that art is an expression. And design is a response to needs. I've had that argument with some of the greatest architects in the world about their buildings, which I think are maybe expression rather than needs. But designers respond to a need. So you've got to actually be able to define that need. I think one of the extraordinary things that Rebuild by Design did, and this is from me talking to some of the design teams as they worked through this project, is they went to the sites and they met real people and they understood the need firsthand, and therefore they dreamt up different solutions, completely different solutions. Normally, if you're a design team, an urban planning design team, a landscape architect, a design team, an engineering team, between you and the origins of the problem, there are layers and layers of filters as funders and clients and project sponsors have actually sort of distilled the problem down to something that can actually be written as a terms of reference to appoint someone. So almost the complexity, the whole procurement process to get design teams in place is almost fundamentally flawed when faced with the complexity of the problems that we're actually asking these teams to solve. And then on a lot of these very big projects, all the design appointments will be different. The engineering team will be appointed, the planning team will be appointed, the landscape architect will be appointed. So they don't even actually come to the table together. let alone bringing, you know, the social scientists with us. So I, you know, I believe passionately in the power of design, the power of creative thinking to actually find solutions to respond to need. But I think Rebuild by Design, for me, this was one of the really very special things that it did, which is concertina all these layers of interface between the need and the range of potential solutions. And so, you know, very, very different solutions emerged than would have happened, and much more quickly than would have happened in a traditional process.
And thank you very much, because this is a great, you know, this is like pivotal, you would say, for Rebuild by Design. And I still remember very well when I entered the United States, suitcase, and, you know, in the federal government. Little crazy place, I must say. Lots of silos, for sure. And one of the first things that happened to me was a workshop in New York, in the federal building, on the highest floor. And all the agencies were there. And it was John Holdren, chief scientist of President Obama, gave a small keynote in the middle to validate the meeting. We had New Jersey state, so the state of New Jersey, state of New York, and the city of New York, representative at the highest level, so the Sandy Tars over there, they were there, the big bosses of all the agencies, and their support staff. And the whole workshop was about, let's define the problems of this region for a competition. And Sean Donovan sent me there, saying, you know, this, you know, you can, this is, this will be, you know, your material. I was asked to give a kickoff presentation that went somewhere different, of course, because I, you know, and then the whole day was about what are the problems of the region. And the end was, we need to put out a question on smart grids, and there was something, you know, of course, why not, eh? And there was something, there were like three. And I remember going home by the train, New York to D.C., thinking, how are we going to tell Sean? Because I now have to step up to my political boss and say, no, this is not what I want. This was really about the in-between. All these layers. There was no design, and there was no community. There was no clue about the situation in the region. But the questions were already drafted. No, let's put out a competition for this and for this and for this. Right. So my critical component, my mantra was, it has to be all about bringing talent to this region. Start to understand and work and talk with everyone. Bring everybody and everything together. And I write it in the book too, because it's also a personal story. So I talk about this. When I presented the approach of asking the world to join us and then work with everyone, not knowing where to go, and then after that finding out what opportunities are and building coalitions based on all the intensive work of collaboration, and only after that come up with an approach where design is actually starting to develop solutions to those questions they helped define themselves in these coalitions, and then do the analysis and the presentations in the end. And I presented it in the task force, and it got silent, and Sean said, and we talked about this afterward, but he on purpose said, do you really think this is the right way? Like, you know, so, I still remember it. I'm physically oriented. I remember the room and the light. And it's like, and I also remember my heartbeat. And I also remember, I said very, yes, I said like too loud. Because I really, and his response was, then we'll do it, which was like a total relief. Still, although I knew he was going to say it, but for the rest of the task force, that was a moment where everybody thought, there are two people are totally crazy. This will never, never fly, because we just took them out of the equation, but brought them in a totally different way. And I think That was the first biggest challenge to overcome. And then connected to that, and now we have to stop it, connected to that, I got a call from the White House, the Office of Management and Budget, because Sean couldn't allocate upfront dollars to projects that didn't exist. But I needed a promise that if the projects were good, that there also was money. Who would else, you know, give in, you know, give a life for a year and then have nothing in their hands? But, and I remember the deputy of OMB giving this line. It was like, you know, he was an American fast, rapid bureaucrat. Like, he was, and he was a great guy. But he said, "So Hank, so if I understand it right, you want the president to commit to $1 billion for projects you don't even know. You don't even know who will be part of it. You don't even know where they are. And you're actually telling me that they might fail because that it's part of the innovation. And you want upfront commitment." He said, "No." It's like, and then they became our best partners. Because they said, "Okay, we will not say we won't fund you." And that was their biggest promise. And that gave us enough leeway to build up capacity also within the federal government, that in the end, when the 6 projects were put on the table, they said yes.
Well, thank you very much for this illustrative example of what the power of design is all about, allowing to fail. But let's open this up. We don't have a lot of time. We are recording this session, so please say who you are. Mary, I cut you off, so I'll take you first, or was this just for clarification? Then let's start here and then walk through. 3 questions, 1 go.
My name is Lucas Oakley.
Is it on? Yeah. Okay.
Hello?
Yes. Perfect.
Lucas Oakley. I work for the Urban Design Studio in Abu Dhabi. I'm really fascinated about this approach in terms of design and this holistic, integrated approach. But the difficulty to sell it, this is maybe a good segue. At what point did you start using the rebuild by design? Because at the same time, I think there was this need to kind of, maybe not simplify, but to brand the approach. So there was something concrete for people to get behind. And what was that process so that people could even get their mind around what is actually happening? Because sometimes the design process, as you very well know, is not necessarily comfortable and predictable process. So just your thoughts on that.
So I guess an indirect compliment on the branding of the whole effort. But please, there's the next question.
My name is Laura Ferrarello, Royal College of Art. Mine is quite a straightforward question. Is it correct to say that one of the legacies or the rebuild by design is the understanding of the value of a shared responsibility to face big problems like climate change?
Thank you. And was there a further hand over there? No? Then let's move over here, please, Patrick. Oh, sorry, where you are? Yeah, please, go ahead, since we're over there.
do you have any comments about how we might...
Sorry, who are you?
Ruben Barker, I'm an architect.
Thank you.
Do you have any comments on how we might better use water or deal with water in London? For instance, I've heard it's quite unusual here that we mix stormwater and sewage together, which can overwhelm the sewage system.
Thank you. Hank, Joe, please, over to you.
Shall I do the first and then you do the second? And then I'll do the third. So the cell. It was called the regional planning and design competition or something. You know, it was bigger. I think a comprehensive regional planning and design collaborative, and so, very policy wise. So, and then we, working title, working around the region, testing, and you know, it was fine. And we could talk to everybody, but then we had to go to the task force, and we all said, this will never fly. So I made a list of 10 names, and I sent them to my wife and others. My wife is a head of communication, so she's very good at this, but others in the task force were too. And we had a top 3, and I picked Rebuild by Design. Yeah, so that's the story. Why? We made it short, and sweet, and also very much what this was about. Second, we knew it was not capturing everything. And we knew because actually rebuild, we wanted to rebuild better. We wanted to improve. We wanted to be adaptive. So there was a lot of no's against rebuild. And then by design, as you said, it's design, eh? You know, it's like, who? Eh? Would Christy understand by design? Or, you know, before you know it becomes very, you know, crazy. Yeah. But we kept it because it did resonate the essence. Yes, design in its capacity to innovate and spur others and bring together, but also have imagination, inspiration, be also very ambitious, aspirational. And yes, it was about rebuilding this region. And by design made it better, more adaptive, more incremental, more resilient. So there was a reason for it, but we knew the aspect. But before that, it was, you know, in the task force report, I was able to write a policy sentence. I drafted it a half pager, then a half, then a quarter, and then it turned into a sentence. Because I wanted to make sure that after this, there was a next step. So I wrote, a little blunt, but still, based on the success of Rebuild by Design, we didn't know it was going to happen, the federal government will partner with its partners, develop a national disaster resiliency competition. And we didn't know it was going to happen, but it did happen. So that became the next layer where design was left out of the equation because Rebuild by Design was perhaps too. Resiliency was incorporated in the national level. Oh, yeah. Oh, shall I do the longer question too? Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's not a good idea. and there are other ways to that too. And it also makes it totally, not totally impossible, but much more costly, not only to deal with the extremes of rain events and, you know, have toilet paper in your streets, but also you can't reuse the water easily. So, third, there are other ways than a sewage to capture rainwater. And the sewage is limited in its capacity, and it's a hell of a burden to take the streets apart, so in parks and on the street and so forth. So rethinking what water is to your city is really an asset, but it's treated as a nuisance. And you have to turn it around as a city immediately.
Linking those two questions, I mean, the branding and the water issue, I don't know if anyone here has come across the work going on in China, where they've coined this phrase sponge city. And, you know, it's incredibly powerful. You know, as soon as I heard it, it was like we knew exactly what it was. Yeah. You know, it's actually we just need to design cities to soak up water. You know, and you know, the sponge city program in China, coinciding with what happened with Hurricane Harvey, where the realization that the amount of hard impermeable surfacing there had such a big thing to do with the amount of water and the way it flowed. It is the branding, I think, is fundamental. You know, there just hasn't been enough good branding around some of these concepts. To answer your question about whether, you know, really this is about a shared responsibility for climate change, I think we have a very fundamental problem because climate change, the problem of climate change, has two halves. One is stopping it getting worse than it is inevitably going to be. And the other is actually the fact that it's impacting people globally and it is impacting the poor and the vulnerable the most. And that doesn't matter whether you are in Nairobi or whether you are in New York. And if you actually go and talk to people, even in New York, who have been impacted by Sandy, there is no connection in their heads between the cause of climate change and what they might be doing in their daily lives to contribute to that as part of the global population and the impact that is being faced locally. The second thing that's really challenging is that to actually, you know, mitigate climate change, we're actually, it's relatively straightforward. It's actually, let's change our energy sources. Let's change our transportation patterns. They're sectoral strategies. But actually, as we saw in New York, the impacts of climate change are incredibly messy and complex problems. So, you know, I don't know whether it, I mean, it is a shared responsibility. It's playing out incredibly unequally. I think we've got to the stage now where there are going to be catastrophic losers in the whole climate change battle. I think people aren't thinking seriously enough about the fact when people can't live where they've been living, they will move. And the consequences of that are not being thought through at all. So we are, I mean, the phrase you use in your book is paralysed fear. You know, it's just such a huge issue. We simply don't know what to do. But on a very personal note, the first week of January this year, I signed a cheque, 2018, or a contract. And I paused and I thought, how interesting. My dad was born 100 years ago. And that felt like a very long time, you know, ago. And a week later, I just happened to be doing some research on life expectancy, because my mum's 85. And I'll be 85 in 2050. And that's how old my dad was when he died. And so my whole time horizon all had been from 2018 to 2050. But I looked at the chart and I realized that my children, who were born in 1999 and 2002, were probably going to be alive, God willing, in 2100. Because of the advances in medical care, etc. And my whole perspective on climate change has changed as a result of that week in January. Because this is no longer for me about 2 degrees. This is actually about what does 3 degrees look like? What do the worst extremes, or even maybe the best possible extremes, by 2100 look like? And I realised that this conversation shifted from being about our grandchildren to being about our children. And, you know, people like me, who have still got quite a lot of life left to do something about it, you know, we need to be, you know, really spending all our energy doing everything we can possibly do and advocating for the urgency of the situation so that it is as least bad as it can be, recognising that we can't fix it. It's too late.
Thank you very much, Joe. And this is too powerful of a closure for me to now talk about 5 extended minutes, which in actual fact we have already spent. So let's leave it at this. Unfortunately, we need to really bring it to a close. But I do want to make one announcement, which is most importantly, this wonderful new book is available. We have a sign-in sheet and you get it for a wonderfully reduced price, if I believe it's £30. Yeah? It's for £30, so there's the sign-in sheet. I want to thank, of course, our panelists. Joe, thank you very much. Henk, thanks for being here today.